This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hi, so I'm here today with Joe Zuntz. Welcome back to the Jodcast Show.
Thank you for having me.
And we thought we'd have you back on the show because you're leaving us soon.
I am. I've been here more than 3 years now, 3.5 years, and I gave a little interview at the beginning when I first joined, so I thought it'd be really nice to do an exit interview, if you like, all the things I've achieved and done over the last 3.5 years.
Yeah, and you might recognise Joe because he's got a few Ask an Astronomers as well, so we're going to have to find someone else to answer your questions once he's gone.
Absolutely, yeah, the general relativity ones and the hardcore quantum ones, what you guys usually left to me, so that was what I ended up doing.
And of course you enjoyed doing that as well.
I did, it was very good fun, yeah, it was great.
So what have you been up to in your 3 years at Manchester?
So I am a weak lenser, so that means most of my work involves looking at the bending of light by gravitational fields. Now that's quite famous, especially these last few years, because it's approaching the centenary of, it's past the centenary of the first measurement of this, which was Arthur Eddington confirming general relativity in a really amazing experiment. It's definitely worth looking up. But what we do now is the same thing on a kind of grand scale. We're interested in mapping out the gravitational fields of the universe by looking at the tiny, tiny distortions that gravity makes on distant galaxies as the light from them passes through the universe and comes to us. So most of my job has been associated with making those maps, so trying to understand how galaxies are distorted by this kind of gravitational effect, so measuring the shapes of very large numbers of very tiny, very blurry galaxies. That's a big chunk of my time. Another big thing that I do is how you kind of get the science from that out at the end. It's all very well making a map or making a big list of all the galaxies and where they are and what shape they have, but there's loads of work to do to actually say, what does this tell us about theories? What does it tell us about how the universe is expanding, about what's in the universe, about the structures in the universe, about the laws of gravity themselves? So all these things we can get a handle on from this kind of measurements, but it's very difficult, it's very complicated. The connection between theory and data is a very long sequence of quite difficult calculations, and trying to put those in a framework where we can do them and where any old theorist can just come along and say, hey, I've got this cool new theory, I'd like to test my awesome theory of gravity, how do I do that? And being able to point them to something to say, hey, this is what you do, is a big part of what I've been trying to do.
So producing those data products almost.
Exactly. So it's data products, but it's also kind of theoretical calculation code as well. So lots of astronomers now, as many of the listeners will know, are programmers, or a big part of our job is computer programming. And that's because, broadly speaking, all the problems that were easy enough to do on paper, we've already done. And so most of what's left, the interesting calculations that we have to do, especially when it comes to big amounts of data, those are things you really have to do in a massive computing kind of way. So we start off with enormous images. So we start off with years and years worth of image data taken from very big telescopes, these enormous sky surveys. And there are loads of processes we go through to try and gradually reduce that down to something more useful. We do a bunch of steps in that process to try and turn raw data into something that's scientifically useful at the end. And that's a very long process.
So you've been very heavily involved in the Dark Energy Survey. Would you like to tell me a bit more about what that survey is aiming to do and what you've done towards it?
Absolutely, yes. So the Dark Energy Survey is one of a few different surveys that are trying to measure big chunks of the sky and trying to measure lensing effects on big chunks of the sky. So DES, we're about 3 years into the 5 or 6 years of DES right now. We've got funding for 5 years and we're hoping for a sixth, fingers crossed. DES is making, over the course of its 6 years, 5 or 6 years, a map of 5,000 square degrees. So that's about an eighth of the entire sky in the southern hemisphere, using a telescope called the Blanco Telescope in central Chile. And what that will hopefully open a window up on for us is the evolution of structure in the universe. So it will tell us, you know, how has structure grown between when the universe was half its current age, for example. And what that in turn gives us a handle on is dark energy. So the big thing that seems very mysterious and bizarre, and it certainly is a name for a strange effect, which is the acceleration of the universe. We're basically certain that the universe is accelerating, but we've really got no idea why. So some theories, like the name sort of suggests, are an energy field that causes this to happen. Lots of other theories involve changing laws of gravity or causing some other effect to try and mimic this acceleration. One effect that the universe accelerating or the universe's expansion history has is on how structure in the universe grows. So that's how what starts off as maybe a small blob of matter, how it accretes more and more matter and then becomes what in the modern universe is a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies. So the idea is that in the early universe, the universe is very, very simple. There's no giant objects. Everything's a very kind of uniform soup of matter. And gradually over the past 14 billion years, that's kind of accreted under gravity to form the giant structures we see in the modern universe, like the really cool dramatic cosmic web pictures that you get if you look at the pictures from these surveys. And how that happens, the details of how that happens, depend very closely on how the universe is expanding. So if we can measure how the structure is growing, we can understand how the universe is expanding and accelerating. And maybe, if we're very lucky, that will give us a handle on the underlying causes of that acceleration. That's the big 5-year goal.
Do you think we will actually have some idea of what causes this acceleration, not even in the next 5 years, but maybe even at 20, 25 years, do you think?
That's a good question. I think we've got a very good chance. No guarantee. Could just be the simplest theory that we have, which is just there is a uniform effect throughout the whole universe accelerating it, which isn't really an explanation, it's just a description really of an effect. If that effect is unchanging with time and unchanging with position, so if it's a totally uniform effect everywhere in space and time, that's both the baseline default answer that we think is the most likely perhaps, but also the one we don't really understand. I mean, we don't really predict why that energy field should have the value it has. It opens up way more questions than it answers. So if we're very lucky, we'll find something different. Maybe we'll find some other effect. Maybe there's some change in time of dark energy. Maybe there's some change in space of dark energy. Maybe it's a dynamic thing. If that happens to be true, and we've gotten, it's very hard to say whether that's likely to be true or not, because it's, you know, that's up to the universe really. But if that turns out to be true, then we're going to find that. That's going to be really, really exciting. There's going to be a tremendous burst of excitement if that really happens. The most likely thing that I think is probably true is this uniform energy field effect. And if that's the case, then instead we learn about all kinds of other stuff with these big surveys. So if we can't learn about dark energy, what we can learn about is dark matter. We can learn about the evolution history of dark matter itself. So we can say how do clouds of dark matter, halos we call them, interact and collide and grow. And what's the effect of that on the galaxies that live in the dark matter as well. So kind of it's a two-pronged thing. Either we find out some amazing stuff about the universe, or if that stuff all turns out to be very straightforward, then we find a bunch of other stuff, sort of exciting science instead.
Or both.
Or both, even better. Yeah, that'd be way more exciting, yeah. And also a whole bunch of, we learn a whole bunch of methods as well. So Dark Energy Survey is ongoing, but most of the time now that I spend over the last few years has been switching to a slightly different experiment, which is called LSST. So that's the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So LSST is DES on steroids. It's a scaled-up version of the same thing, if you like. It's got a particularly exciting focus, which is being really, really fast. So it's a telescope that can take images very, very quickly. And so it can be amazing for doing studies of transient things. So you can look at a place in the sky and then go away and then come back very, very frequently because you're moving around so quickly. So that'll be great for studying supernovae, where you want to look away, look back again, look away, look back again. It'll be great for studying things in our solar system as well. So dwarf planets and asteroids. It's going to make the biggest asteroid catalogue that's ever been made. So it'll be great for protecting us from killer asteroids. It's going to be the first
but
chance.
But it doesn't mean we can do anything about them.
Not as such, no. But it's, you know, the first step is knowing if there's a threat out there, certainly. But it's also going to be great for lensing. So it can map out a very big area, and that's the one thing we really, really need to be able to do these lensing experiments really, really well. It's going to make a huge, huge map. So in the first 2 months of LSST, it can do the same as the entire 6-year dark energy survey.
Wow,
so it's kind of just massively compressed timescale. But of course that means we have to learn really, really well how to do this analysis. So in lots of areas of astronomy and wider science, you're torn in two directions in your experiments. And one is just random errors, just things that you kind of understand in your data. You know, we know that, you know, galaxies are sort of randomly positioned, so we have a sort of random signal with how many we happen to pick up in a given place. And we have to understand that, and that's called noise sometimes. So we get noise in electronics, in telescope cameras, all those kinds of things. And that's the thing we kind of understand. It's a known unknown, if you like. What we have to find, and you can always improve that by building a bigger telescope and building, you know, more powerful detectors. You can always kind of beat that down by doing
more data.
More data will always beat that down. What more data won't always beat down is what we call systematic errors. Very generally, it's an unknown unknown. So it's something where you think there may be a problem with this data. It's perhaps caused by this effect, but I don't really have a sense of how big this problem is, you know, what exactly it's doing. So there's a bunch of those that hit us in lensing surveys. One is that it's very hard to know how far away galaxies are. So it's a very, very difficult process to figure out how far away a galaxy is, because you just see in the data, you just see a little blob. And it could be a big blob that's close by or a small blob that's a long way away. And we have a bunch of methods for trying to figure that stuff out. But if those methods are wrong, that's going to really affect our results in a way we may not really understand. So what we've really got to do for LSST and these big upcoming surveys, and this LSST is starting in 2020 and will be a 10-year mission, is really understand these very difficult effects and these details of what's hitting our data. And if we can do that, then we can really understand the kind of full power that LSST will get us. If we try to do that now, we'd have no chance. You know, it sounds like DES is pointless if you can do the whole thing in 2 months of LSST, but it certainly isn't. And we have no chance of understanding the data LSST will tell us without years of practice, really.
It's like a stepping stone.
It's a stepping stone, exactly. You can't, you know, you can't jump straight to the end of the whole thing. You have to learn how to use this kind of data and learn what the problems with it are. I'm making that sound very positive and very fun, but actually, of course, what I mean is that we spend years and years stuck on bizarre problems and just confusing issues with our data.
Getting very stressed.
Getting very stressed and, you know, having big arguments about, no, my bit's working, yours isn't working, that kind of thing. So that's been a big chunk of the last few years, yeah, it's that kind of confusion.
So, because that's something that always intrigues me, and actually when I've given like talks and stuff in public, people actually are very interested in how do you go and disentangle all of those things, because obviously you've got lots of different systematics, and how can you figure out which one is causing what?
Absolutely, and there isn't really a general prescription. That's one of the problems with this thing. There's a few kind of techniques and tricks you can do to tease out things like, is what I'm seeing an effect in the telescope, perhaps, or in the atmosphere that's messing with my data, or is it a real thing in the real universe? So one of those that we call null tests. So a null test is a comparison or a study or a test, an analysis of data, which should give you nothing. It should give you a zero result. And very commonly, that might be, for example, measuring a property of stars or galaxies on two different days of the week.
Okay.
Now, stars shouldn't really change, or most stars shouldn't really, galaxies certainly shouldn't really change from one day to the next, because they last hundreds of millions, billions of years. So, you know, Monday versus Tuesday shouldn't really make much of a difference. So if you do sort of Tuesday minus Monday in your analysis, that should really be zero. If there's a difference between Tuesday's data and Monday's data, then you've probably made a mistake somewhere or something's probably gone wrong. Or if there's a difference between data you took towards the end of the night and the beginning of the night, that would be an indication, because that's really a local thing. It's about our telescope and the Earth, not about the universe. So if there's a difference between those two things, that's a kind of a clue that something's gone wrong. So we have lots of those. Unkind people have suggested we should do that with observers. So we should say, let's take away observations you took minus observations I took and see if we have different results. So a big part of our work is sort of constructing tests like that, constructing things where if the only thing out there was out in the universe, if there were no problems with our telescope, no problems with the atmosphere, no problems with our data analysis at all, then we should get no results. Mm-hmm. And then if we do get a result, if we see actually that's not quite true, maybe something's gone wrong. So one example would be we pick a bunch of random positions in our sky map, and we take an average shape of galaxies around those random positions. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't have any particular signal to it, because we just chose a place at random. It shouldn't be there. The galaxy shouldn't be pointing, you know, any particular way towards or around any given random point in the sky. So with enough random points, we expect to beat that down to zero. You know, if we average the shapes of galaxies around random points, we should get no particular direction to them. Mm-hmm. And if we do, that's telling us we've probably messed up some step along the way in either looking at our images or looking at our data in some other way. So there's a whole enormous process for doing this. The other thing we kind of do is model all our errors. So we try and say, what are the things that could go wrong with our data? Let's try and understand them. And let's make a model for them. Let's say, just like we make models for things out there in the universe, we make models of the universe, we make models of galaxies, we also make models of things that can go wrong. So we make models of the errors in measuring distances to galaxies. So we say, okay, say we get distances wrong by 10%. What does that do? And we try and build a model of those errors just like we do the real universe. So in a really rich picture, in a very coherent picture, you try to turn all these systematic errors into statistical ones. So you're trying to say, all these things I don't really understand, I've at least turned into numbers that I can try and measure. And that's not perfect, because you don't really know what's going on in a lot of these problems, but it's certainly the first step towards trying to understand them.
So given that LSST is 4 years away now, is that, 4 years?
4 years or so, yes, that's right.
Yeah. So what for you do you think is the biggest challenge you're going to face? And what's the thing you're kind of worried about now, not getting it right in time?
That's a good question. So two main things I'm worried about most. One is that LSST is, because it's such a fast telescope, it's going to take thousands of pictures of every individual galaxy. So it's not going to take one very, very beautiful picture of a galaxy. It's going to take 1,000 kind of blurry, mm-hmm. noisy pictures of a galaxy. And that makes it very, very difficult to analyse that data, because on the face of it, you've got 1,000 times as much data that you have to analyse. So if all the methods we've been using so far on DES, we tried to use those in LSST, we'd spend the next 100 years running computer programs to do this. You know, that's a very big worry, just the kind of volume of everything that we have to do for LSST. The other, for me, is distances to galaxies. So we call these redshifts in astronomy. So the redshift is to do with how much the universe has expanded since the galaxy you're looking at emitted its light. So it's how old the light is you're looking at, and that's a kind of proxy for distance. And that's a very challenging thing to measure, so very worried about that as well.
What makes it hard to measure that?
So there's a few ways you can try and measure the distance to a galaxy. If it's a nearby galaxy, you can use methods like Cepheids or Cepheids, which rely on measuring individual stars in those galaxies and measuring their behaviour. The galaxies we're talking about are way too far away to do anything like that, so we can't really do that. For our galaxies, we have to find other methods. Now, if you can find the redshift of a galaxy, the redshift of a galaxy you measure inherently by taking a spectrum of the galaxy. So you say, I can look at the light emission from this galaxy and I can see lines in it, in particular colours. So I can look for the line that hydrogen emits, for example, or the lines that hydrogen emit, and a bunch of other signals as well. That's great, and that works incredibly well. You get a super high precision redshift from doing that. Problem is that it takes a very long time for any one galaxy, so you have to spend ages and ages staring at one galaxy in order to do this. And that doesn't really fit in with what we want, which is to have a huge area of sky. We'd have to focus on a few galaxies for a really, really long time to be able to do that. Instead, what we do is a kind of a proxy for that. We can't afford to stare at one galaxy without a spectrum for a very long time. What we can do is put filters in front of our telescope. So we have a red filter and a green filter and an infrared filter and a whole sequence of different filters. So that means you're essentially measuring the amount of light in a galaxy in a few different colours in sort of broad bands. And the idea is that's kind of acts like a very, very crude spectrum. So it acts like a very, very low resolution spectrum. And hopefully if we can model galaxies well enough, then we can understand by looking at this very, very low resolution spectrum, we can at least get a very noisy measurement of the redshift of a galaxy. The problem is that that sort of depends on having a bunch of galaxies whose redshift you know really, really well and perfectly to calibrate. So you want to say, okay, these are ones where I know the correct answer and here's what it looks like in my data, so I can like make a map from one of those to the other. The difficulty is that it's very, very hard to get enough galaxies and the same population of galaxies, the same sample of galaxies, to match between the two sets, between your giant sample of billions of galaxies and your high-precision, high-resolution set, because they don't really match up. For example, we get much fainter galaxies when we look at the big survey compared to the small regions. So that's why it's a very challenging process to do, because you're trying to mesh together two things that don't really mesh together.
That's really interesting to hear, yeah. And good luck with that, if it goes well. So you're moving to Edinburgh soon. What are you looking forward to most moving?
Yes, I'm going to Edinburgh, so I'm going to have a very interesting job title there. So I'm going to be a Chancellor's Fellow in Astrophysics and Big Data. Big data is a cool new thing that all the cool kids are doing right now. And it's very, very appropriate to astronomy. So astronomers have been dealing with large amounts of data for a very, very long time. What my new job will involve is trying to learn the lessons we've learned from doing that and the methods and the tools and the research we've done into how to handle these big data sets. How can we use that to benefit the wider economy? How can we benefit companies that maybe want to learn how to handle big data or do big analyses? And how can we benefit non-profits and all of those kind of things as well? So we're trying to have some impact beyond just traditional astronomy and trying to use all these methods we've got really, really good at using out in the wider world. So I guess I'm looking forward to that very much indeed.
Yeah, that sounds quite exciting, really. Are there any cases already where kind of those techniques are already applied?
There are a few, yeah. So they're not always good. So physics has always given lessons to the financial industry in particular. Mm. So a great many people who are kind of former physicists go off and work in quantitative finance. That's one area where it's been very strong. Obviously, sometimes they cause horrifying crashes. we don't like to talk about that. But so finance has been one area where there's been a very strong connection in astronomy as well, wider areas. But what we kind of think is we can probably move beyond that. You know, finance is a really interesting area that we think we can learn a lot, but we think there's other companies and other industries that really want to use, you know, big data sets and really understand them. So healthcare is a very interesting one.
Oh, I love that.
Doctors collect huge amounts of information from millions and billions of patients around the world, and locked away in that information is all kinds of cures, really. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of facts in there about what methods work and what don't. That's really very hard to analyse, partly because you're dealing with such large amounts of data, and partly because it's very complicated. So, you know, it's not like we're very kind of spoilt in physics because we see it's very simple. And we have very often large number statistics. So we're going to measure 100 billion galaxies with LSST. Mm-hmm. Lots of medical situations really only have, you know, a handful of patients to deal with. But that makes sort of doing proper statistics and proper analyses very, 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 very important when you've got a very small number of people. And we've seen the results in lots of high-profile situations
when that's gone wrong.
So it's a very challenging thing to do.
Okay, well, it's been great to have you back on the Jodcast.
Thanks so much. It's been really nice to be on here and also to be around in Manchester for a good few years.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll catch up with you again soon and find out how you're getting on in Edinburgh.
I hope so. That'd be nice.
All right, thanks very much. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for that, Monique.
Now, Charlie interviews Katie Depp.